Hello, Dr. Cohn, and thank you so much for being with us on Equal Time for Free Thought. We're so glad you can join us.
Thank you very much.
Your book calls for a major reconsideration of the way that most people traditionally regard human behavior. Rather than characterizing behavior in judgmental terms, you're arguing for descriptive language that reflects a scientific understanding.
Yeah, that's right. In particular, in relation to when people act with kindness or with cruelty, how we understand the causes of those actions. So traditionally, we've said that when people show cruelty, it's a sign that they might be evil. And that's especially true when we're talking about extreme acts of cruelty. But, you know, we can think of kindness or cruelty as just being on a spectrum. And the question really is, what's giving rise to those kinds of actions? And talking about it in terms of evil, I think, isn't really very helpful. I mean, it's not scientific. It's not really an explanation, because it's even dangerously circular.
Hmm.
And if you look at the word evil, all it really means is the absence of good. So what we're saying is someone did something bad because they're not good.
Right.
It doesn't really take us any further. So I've been trying to shift the debate onto more scientific grounds by looking at the concept of empathy, and in particular the erosion of empathy, how we might lose our empathy in different situations for either social reasons or biological reasons, and arguing that empathy is something that is it is tractable scientifically. We can measure it, and we can look at what influences it.
There's a lot of resistance in our popular culture to give up these very traditional, religious, essentially supernatural ways of understanding human behavior. I so agree with you about how nebulous and unworkable a word like evil is. We don't really understand somebody saying that someone's possessed by an evil force that's outside of them, or are they saying that they're the source of this evil, or that they are possessed of an evil force outside of them, but they're to blame because they came to it because of their free will. It seems impossible to really understand what someone means when they use the word evil. But yet, certainly here in the United States, and I would imagine to a lesser extent in Britain, but still to some extent, it seems like anyone who argues against using a term like evil is immediately branded as being morally indifferent, dangerously naive, or self-deluded. And people who use the word evil are applauded for being decisive and having deep moral conviction. Do you get that kind of pushback?
Couple of points that you make. The first is that you're suggesting people might be very resistant to giving up the concept of evil.
Mm.
And I'm not sure that we know that. I think that, you know, we resort to the use of the term evil and the concept very readily. It's kind of almost automatic that somebody commits a murder or commits some other awful act like rape, and we immediately use that term evil to try and explain it. But I think that may simply be because the concept has been around for a long time, so it's very ingrained, and it's part of our cultural vocabulary, if you like. So it's kind of second nature just to reach for it. But if there was an alternative in place, it may be that people would be willing to replace it. So I think that, you know, it remains to be seen. I mean, I'm trying to start that discussion to say, you know, should we be looking for a concept that is more scientifically grounded, more rational, let's say, because as you point out, when we talk about somebody being evil, it refers to, you know, like supernatural possession.
Yeah.
That they're being possessed by some supernatural force, and, you know, that is quite unlikely. And there are a lot of alternatives that are now available through scientific methods that we can explore in a more evidence-based way.
Right.
And I think the other point about if you don't use the term evil, then you're somehow not operating from a moral basis. I think that could also be challenged. I mean, I think the morality is extremely important for our society, but it doesn't have to be a morality based on supernatural concepts. It can be a morality that's based on all kinds of principles, such as not hurting one another and establishing limits on what is socially acceptable or unacceptable. So I think just because we might be trying to explore whether we can use a different framework like empathy doesn't mean that we're abandoning any moral position.
If we're going to replace evil with the idea of empathy, what exactly is empathy?
So obviously it's a word that we use all the time in the English language, but as a scientist, I try to give it a very precise definition. In my definition, there are two components to empathy. The first is the drive to put yourself into someone else's shoes, to imagine what someone else is thinking or feeling. So that's the sort of recognition element, recognizing what someone might be thinking or feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And psychologists also call that the cognitive component of empathy. And then the second component is the drive to respond with an appropriate emotion to someone else's thoughts and feelings. So again, psychologists call that the affective component, and it's really the response element. And I think that those two components, you need to keep them distinct, because you do meet individuals where they may have one component working just fine, but may lack the second component. And you can find the opposite patterns too. So the fact that different medical conditions can affect either one or other of these components suggests that they may be independent of each other.
I know that in your book, it seems that you're expressing empathy as being able to see another person's humanity and being able to recognize it as one of the components, as you say, like a spotlight on that person, and then being able to respond to it. And there's a range of the degrees of empathy. I guess you have six levels of empathy,
yeah.
The least being what you call 0 degrees of empathy.
That's right. So, in fact, in the UK, the title of the book is 0 degrees of Empathy. In the US, the publisher advised using a different title, which is The Science of Evil. But that idea about 0 degrees of empathy is meant to imply that there is that empathy isn't all or none. You don't either have it or lack it,
right.
But it comes by degrees. And as you said, there are in the book the suggestion is that you can divide the empathy spectrum into six different levels. Most of us are kind of average in empathy, so we'd be at level 3. And some people are very high in empathy, up at level 5 or 6. But the book explores particularly what are the different ways that you can lose your empathy and then ending up very low at, say, level 2 or 1 or even 0. And it looks at both social factors, particularly in relation to propaganda and the way we stereotype people who are not part of our group, and how that can sometimes lead us to treat them without humanity, without any consideration of their thoughts and feelings. So social factors of that kind, but also biological factors, because it's apparent that there are genes that are associated with levels of empathy. and forms of brain damage that can selectively affect your empathy and other biological factors.
You also distinguish between temporary loss of empathy that maybe all of us experience at some time under stress or when our bodies are going through hormonal changes or various kinds of other factors in our lives that might lower our level of responsiveness to another person. But then there are people that suffer with a permanent deficit of empathy.
Yeah, that's right. So the transient changes in empathy, I think we're all aware of, you know, when we're tired or maybe when we've had a little bit too much to drink, it can be quite difficult to maintain a clear focus on somebody else's state of mind. And as you mentioned, when you're under stress, it's difficult if you feel threatened or if you feel angry to also empathize with another person. But those are very reversible states. And what the book looks at is individuals who show low empathy in a more permanent way. And again, that might be for environmental reasons, such as children who've suffered neglect or abuse in early development and who grow up with low levels of empathy, really because they've never experienced affection and the experience of being cared for by a parent figure. And just as the psychologist John Bowlby argued, the lack of early experience of care can also mean that you have difficulty expressing care and compassion when you're older.
Mm.
So, you know, he famously followed children who'd really been brought up in children's homes or institutions, but didn't really have the opportunity to experience parental love, and found that many of them developed delinquency and antisocial behavior, where they didn't really think about other people's feelings. They just thought about their own feelings, their own needs. So that would be a social cause to low empathy.
One thing that struck me about John Bowlby's work is how old it is, how even in the 1940s, he was writing that when we look at people who do harm to others, there are causes, and this is not the result of their deciding to be bad people or their volition or all the things that we seem to still be imbued with in our social thinking. And it's astonishing that we're looking at half a century, if not more, of voluminous data that should suggest that our behavior is caused, and when people are healthy and mature, they have an adequate level of empathy to be responsive to the world around them. They don't have an over amount of it that it would actually inhibit them pursuing their own life goals, but they have an adequate amount to be cooperative and responsive.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm interested by your observation that John Bowlby's work is quite old, back in the 1940s and 50s.
Hmm.
I would say that actually that was a turning point for society. And you could almost pinpoint that is the beginning of the modern age, because, you know, before that, it seemed to be acceptable to treat children as if they didn't have feelings. Examples being that certainly in England, in some social classes, people would send their children away to boarding school, believing that this would be good for the child, when in fact it was breaking very important emotional bonds between parent and children. Or they would send children out to work and under terrible conditions in the Victorian age, even as young as 5 years old, without much consideration for the emotional impact on young children. And, you know, corporal punishment was, you know, considered acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think what we now know since the work of John Bowlby is that these kinds of experiences have long-lasting effects on children. If they're separated from their parents, if they're physically abused or emotionally abused. And, you know, the fact that he published books and papers about that led to all kinds of changes in society. And I'm sure that, you know, these changes have been very widespread, so in your country just as in mine. But that when, for example, a child has to go to hospital, these days the parents go with the child and stay with the child. Whereas before Bowlby's work, it was commonplace that you had to hand over your child to the nurses so that they not only had to go through the medical procedures, but they were also experiencing parental, you know, a loss of parental affection.
Right, right. Child-rearing practices have certainly progressed, but in terms of the overall social narrative of people, you know, it seems like you're saying the default set, and you and a great many social scientists are saying that our default setting for a healthy, mature adult individual is to behave in ways that are socially desirable, and that when we don't behave in ways that are socially desirable, it's indicative of some deficit, some problem, something that went wrong that we should think of in terms of reducing the harm and not inflicting retributive punishments and making things even worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, that's my position. But I guess what we're learning through science is that empathy is a process that exists, but it needs certain conditions to grow. It needs certain inputs. So just as there are other psychological processes that depend on experience, language being a good one, you know, that human beings will develop language, but they do also need to hear language and to have the opportunity to practice language in order for it to develop in a normal way. So the same is true for empathy, that the circuitry is all there waiting to be developed. It's probably there because it's the result of our evolution, that it's very useful to have empathy. As you say, it enables cooperation, and it enables us to really you know, live harmoniously in social groups because we are able to imagine what somebody else might be thinking or feeling. But, you know, that circuitry won't just grow by itself. It does need, as Bowlby's work illustrated, it does need very critical input at critical points in development, probably in the first few years of life. The experience of being cared for, and it's a lesson that we need to keep repeating. It's a message we need to keep repeating because we know we can see all around us in communities where there is you know, there's a lot of stress, that it's very easy for parents to lose sight of the impact of their own behavior on their children.
This social scientific view of our human experience and our potentially socially well-adapted cooperative nature when our environment supports it, I see this tension between that view and while our child-rearing practices might have progressed, it seems like the last half of a century has actually taken us in a direction where we've embraced even more harsh prison sentences, the United States has renewed its zeal for military solutions. The rugged individualism of let's abandon social safety net programs in Britain and the United States have become a very strong sentiment in the population. So it seems that the message that social scientists are trying to get across has run into a lot of resistance by this narrative that basically says, look, people are going to be selfish, lazy, and greedy as a default setting unless they're coerced by the threat of harsh consequences or the lure of excessive rewards. Mm. And that seems to be the narrative that's being embraced, which is the opposite of what people like yourself seem to be advocating.
I mean, you know, my response to that would be because I'm seeing the world from a different country. That maybe your observations are because you're within the U.S. and that you're describing a particular American view. So for example, here in England, we have a lot of safety nets that are provided by the state when people have difficulties, one example being the National Health Service, so socialized medicine, so that no matter what your income, you know that you can see the best doctor at any time, any time you need them. And even when we have a change of government towards a more conservative or a more liberal government, that institution of the National Health Service is regarded as a kind of sacred institution.
Right.
That we recognize that's, if you like, a very empathic or very compassionate institution to provide. And, obviously Britain's had a different history.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of reminding you and your listeners that maybe what's happening in the last few decades in the U.S. and the debates that are happening around what the government should provide are in some ways, quite unique to the U.S. It's not necessarily reflecting, humanity more broadly.
Yes, we seem to be much more ruggedly individualistic in our thinking and less inclined toward supporting a social safety net than our European counterparts. However, the last few decades have seen a reduction in the commitment to those social safety net structures in Europe as well.
I'm not sure about that reduction. But,
right, okay.
I guess I'm just pointing out that there are other models.
Right, right.
The other example I would point to, because you mentioned the prison service, I think you were indicating that maybe prisons are becoming tougher places as a kind of deterrent. And certainly deterrents are important. We need to be sending out signals to people that there will be consequences if they hurt other people. But I'm also struck, again, here in the UK, you can find examples where there's a very blurred line between the prison service and the health service. So an example would be Broadmoor Hospital, which is where psychopaths get sent. So people with psychopathic personality disorder, many of whom have committed horrific crimes like serial murder. But interestingly, although it's a locked environment, it's a secure environment for the safety of everybody, it is nevertheless a hospital. So, the concept of the prison and the hospital is overlapping, because it's recognized that maybe these individuals have committed their crimes because of the way their brain functions, and that, instead of punishing the person for the way their brain works, we as a society should have compassion for individuals, even if they've committed crimes, and we should be offering them treatment if there are treatments available.
you are making an impassioned argument for relying on empathy as being far more effective and potent at healing the challenges to being a healthy, stable society, more than our legal system, our prison system, our military. You really spell it out at the end of your book that empathy is something that can transform us.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that, you know, we do have these alternative strategies available to us, like using military might and strength to resolve conflicts, or using the legal process to try and resolve conflicts. But it seems that in the long run, even if you've tried those other strategies, there'll still be a need for sitting down and talking and listening to each other to arrive at some kind of negotiated, you know, resolution to a conflict. And if that's going to be the case, if that's always the end game, then, you know, part of what my book raises towards the end of the book is whether we should just stop and think and maybe bypass those very expensive options, the military options, the legal options, expensive either in economic terms or often in terms of human life, and instead just use what's a resource which is available to us, which is empathy, where we sit and listen to the other person's point of view. Because often just the process of listening and talking can lead to conflict resolution. And the example that I give at the end of my book is in the Middle East, where we've had 60 years of conflict between Israel and Palestine. And military strategies have been used with a depressing kind of cycle of violence, you know, where one side will attack and the other side will
retaliate.
Yeah. And the cycle just goes on. It doesn't seem to lead to a solution. It might temporarily make one side feel a little bit stronger that they're fighting back. But, you know, the cycle, if you take the broader view, over 60 years, things don't seem to be any better. And, you know, the contrast would be individuals on both sides of that political divide who have very bravely decided to form relationships with the enemy, Palestinians and Israelis getting to know each other and forming friendships just by the act of empathy, realizing that they're actually in a very similar situation to each other. They're both on both sides. People are losing relatives in the conflict. They're suffering the same emotions of sorrow and bereavement and pain, and that they can actually identify with each other by talking.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I think these are just different ways of thinking about how we should be behaving. And that's obviously a very local conflict, but it has implications for more global conflicts that perhaps the U.S. feels that they're engaged in.
I'm wondering how you feel about the way that we're pitted in these adversarial relationships. Your book had me thinking about what happens when my relative economic clout is much higher than those around me. Like if I go on a vacation to a place where the median income is much lower than mine, I'll have all these people around me, the hotel staff or wait staff, that are acting in a subordinate fashion. And it seems as if I'm confronted with one or two not so great choices. Either I can have my empathy turned on and notice how stressed out this older gentleman than me, somebody 20 years my senior, is stressed out and overworked and trying to wait on me and feel uncomfortable with that. Or I can just rationalize that he's probably glad to have this job and best I can do is leave a nice tip. Maybe this is the best thing for him. It seems that people who are more affluent than I, who have people around them all the time serving them have to turn off that normal part of empathizing with the people around them just in order to maintain that hierarchical position.
It's a very interesting observation, you know, whether your position in the social hierarchy by itself or necessarily has an impact on your empathy, that the higher you get, the less empathy you can afford to have, you know, if you're going to maintain your higher status.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say that there doesn't have to be a necessary link, that just because you're richer than somebody or more senior than them in the organization, or it doesn't mean that you need to turn off your empathy. And, you know, you can still treat a person as a person with feelings and with dignity. So, again, I think what the book tries to do is remind us that sometimes our situation, as you describe it in that very good example, we might almost automatically be switching off our empathy, but we should stop and think, you know, if we do that, you know, what are the next steps? What could that lead to? Could that lead to us treating someone who is lower in the hierarchy in inhumane ways? So, you know, and you know, there's a long history of slavery where rich landowners felt it was okay to treat their servants, beating them, not giving them adequate housing. You know, I think, you know, again, the progression that we've seen in history, which ended the slave trade, you could also see that as, you know, remembering that empathy has to have a place, that otherwise we were in danger of just treating people not as people but as objects.
That's a good transition to maybe talk a little bit more specifically about autism. How are autistic disorders related to a deficit of empathy?
So, yeah, this is, I think, an area that is getting a lot of research, and I don't think all the evidence is in yet. But from my reading of the evidence so far, I would say that people with autism, they have difficulties with cognitive empathy. That was that first component, which involves recognizing what someone else might think or feel. They struggle to do that and to understand what someone else's intentions or motives or beliefs might be. Hmm. But as far as I can see, they don't have any difficulties with affective empathy. So if they hear that somebody else is suffering, it upsets them. And in that way, they're not like psychopaths. So people with autism don't tend to hurt other people. They tend to be confused by other people. And, you know, one implication is that if you struggle with cognitive empathy, that leads to social confusion. Mm. And it leads people to withdraw. And, you know, and sometimes it means social isolation. But, you know, usually the evidence suggests, anyway, that it's only when you lose your affective empathy that you become more capable of hurting another person. And that seems to be more true of the psychopath.
There are severe conditions of autism, such as people who will just stare at the wall, or when, I think you've mentioned, when a hand reaches out to them, they're not relating to the hand as being a person's hand, but more like an object.
Yeah. So, you know, I think they reflect difficulties in reading other people's behavior and imagining what's going on in someone else's mind. And that seems to be a core difficulty for people with autism. And, you know, what teachers and therapists need to be doing is finding a way around that, maybe by providing the information more explicitly. So whereas the rest of us may just look at someone's face and be able to infer what the other person might think or feel. We can read the body language, and a lot of that is nonverbal. People with autism don't seem to be able to decode that kind of information. They can look at a face and be completely puzzled by it. Mm. They can listen to intonation, to a tone of voice, and not be able to pick up at what the other person might be feeling or what their intentions are. For example, that they're sarcastic. So they might need the information delivered in a much more explicit fashion. But as I was saying earlier, that once they're told that someone might be unhappy or somebody might be stressed, that bothers them and they want to do something about it. So the suggestion is that people with autism do have a moral code and they do have affective empathy in the sense that they care about others, but they just have trouble reading other people's behavior.
But you're not talking about the kind of severe autism that renders someone unresponsive.
Well, I think that group of people are very difficult to study and to test.
Right.
So you gave the example earlier of someone with autism who just stares at the wall and may have very little language. And, you know, at a minimum, we can say that someone like that is very socially withdrawn. They're not interacting. Maybe they're very isolated. But it's very hard to know what their level of affective empathy is like. Hmm. It's a bit easier to study and to test in people with autism who have more language and who can participate in research studies. I think my reading of the evidence is that where it's possible to study them, people with autism do have intact affective empathy. And so by extension, it may be true also even of those individuals at the severe end of the spectrum. Hmm. And it's just a matter of whether scientists can come up with new ways to test or measure empathy, even in people who have maybe no language.
What about the general impression in our society that there's an ever larger percentage of the general population suffering with autism today than at previous times? Is there a true epidemic, or is that because the condition's more widely recognized? What's going on with that?
Yeah, I would say the latter, that we've become better at recognizing it, and we're just more aware, so there's greater awareness. I think there's also just there are more services out there too for people with autism. Mm-hmm. So that's contributed to the greater awareness. If you went back 30 years, there would have been very few clinics that specialized in autism, whereas today, in every small town, there'll be a clinic that is able to make the diagnosis and offer services. So I think just the growth of services on the ground means that there are many more professionals who are kind of alert and looking for autism. So by itself, that could have resulted in greater numbers of people getting diagnosed. But I think the other big change is that we've broadened the definition of autism. That 30 years ago, we really only picked up the more severe cases, the kinds of people we were just talking about, maybe who not only had autism, but also had learning difficulties, what in the U.S. you call retardation.
Mm-hmm. Or developmental delay, yes.
We call developmental delays. Mm-hmm. And maybe language difficulties too. Whereas these days, you know, we recognize this other group, Asperger's syndrome. Mm-hmm. So individuals who've got good language and good intellectual skills, but who still have difficulties with forming relationships and who become quite obsessive. And the fact that, you know, the definition of autism has broadened into a spectrum to include even these high-functioning individuals, that's also contributed to the increase in numbers.
we have people who are sounding alarm bells all over the place about this burgeoning epidemic, but do you think that that's overstated?
Yeah, I wouldn't really use the word epidemic, partly because it is very alarmist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that maybe what we're seeing is that when new studies come out reporting a much higher rate of autism than we previously thought, that actually all that's happening is we're getting closer to the true rate. So when I started research into autism more than 25 years ago, the reported rate was 4 children in every 10,000.
Hmm.
And today the rate is about 1 in 100, 1%. So that's a huge increase.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect, as I said, that all that's really happening is that we're picking up cases that we used to miss, and we're picking up the more subtle or milder cases too, and that, you know, it may be the case that the true rate is even higher. Maybe it's closer to 2%, but that we're just getting closer and closer to the true rate as we no longer miss people who need a diagnosis.
I've heard reports that most children are subjected to ineffectual treatments, non-evidence-based beliefs and treatments of the causes of autism, and treatments for autism seem to be plentiful. Is it true that most children with autism are subjected to treatments that are ineffective and
right,
frequently unpleasant or worse?
Well, that's difficult to say. I mean, you're right that we need more studies to look at which treatments work and for whom, because it's not necessarily going to be the case that a single treatment is relevant for all cases of autism. Different types, different subgroups, different individuals might need different kinds of treatment. But treatment research is very expensive and very time-consuming. You know, typically to conduct a study looking at the both the benefits but also the side effects of a treatment can take 3 years of research, a lot of money and a lot of resources, really.
Mm.
So often practitioners are just jumping in to offer treatments which haven't been through a rigorous evaluation. And the gold standard for evaluation is the randomized control trial. It's called RCT, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have a group of people with the diagnosis, and they are randomly assigned into a treatment group and a no treatment group, and then you compare them before and after to see whether the treatment really is having any benefit. But Those are very time-consuming studies, but we still need them. There's no real way around it.
Right, and you need large enough, and you need large enough samples for it to be statistically significant.
Absolutely right. Yeah. So, you know, the other point you made is that, you know, is to ask whether people with autism are being given treatments that might even be unpleasant, and I would hope that that's no longer the case. Certainly, it was true back in the 1960s, that forms of behaviorism were used, where the effort was to try to teach people with autism to shape their behavior using rewards, but also using punishments. And I think these days the use of punishment is very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, you know, it's not used at all. And instead, there is much more of a focus on the use of rewards,
mm-hmm,
in those behavioral approaches. My own view is that if you need to be using artificial rewards, then it may be that the treatment is not really very relevant,
mm,
to the patient, to the person with autism, and that other methods might be more motivating if they're designed to be autism-friendly.
I've known families that impose dietary restrictions, like not allowing the children to have weed, or families that use these oxygen pressurized tanks or something if they get into with the children, and all kinds of things that are really questionable. And I guess people are desperate and they're sort of reaching for straws. But are there treatments that you personally recommend that do seem to work?
Yeah, I mean, just on the examples you used, you know, dietary treatments, really need to be undertaken carefully and under the supervision of a nutritionist. It is the case that many people with autism not just suffer from their autism, but they suffer from gastrointestinal issues. And some of those may be based in terms of food allergies, but whether you need group studies or even just individual case studies to establish if a diet may be beneficial or harmful, you know, I think it does need very careful evaluation. But you were asking about, you know, treatments that are recommended, and you know, I would say that the evidence isn't pointing to any single or specific treatment as being better than the rest. The evidence is probably pointing to early intervention being important, and exposing the child to a lot of social stimulation, but doing so in a way that doesn't stress the child.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people argue that that children with autism do best in structured environments where there's predictability, that they find it, you know, much more stressful if they're put into a situation which is lacking structure. So there are kind of general principles that good schools and clinics for kids with autism are implementing, but in terms of is one treatment better than another, That doesn't seem to be a clear case yet.
What about technology? I once heard about a telephone device that is able to detect emotion in the voice of the person on the other side of the line and light up appropriately to indicate when the other person seems to be indicating anger or frustration, or to cue the person with autism, something that they wouldn't otherwise be able to perceive.
Yeah, I mean, these are very interesting developments, you know, that nowadays computers can be used as assistive devices to help someone read emotions. I think at the moment, you know, whether we're talking about an app on your iPhone or some other computer device, the range of emotions that computers can read are still quite limited. But it's pointing in the future to the possibility that you could use technology to help someone read emotion, just as, for example, someone with hearing impairment might be helped by having a hearing aid. So I think, you know, as we were saying earlier, that treatments need to be evaluated, but the use of new technology is certainly an exciting way forward. I guess the other thing to mention is that you know, we were saying people with autism like predictability, and computers offer predictability in a way that that learning from a person may not.
Right.
So if you're trying to teach social skills, it may be that for people with autism, they would prefer to learn from a computer than from another person.
Yes, a computer does not roll their eyes at you when you haven't gotten it for the third time.
Yeah, it's, that's right. You can keep repeating the exercises and, you know, at your own pace, and you can be sure that you'll get the same outcome every time on the computer, whereas with a human teacher, there's so much variability in his or her actions that might just be adding to the confusion for a child with autism.
Are there questions that a parent with an autistic child should be asking, that they should be concerned with, that they should be asking their provider about, or things they should definitely avoid? Is there anything that strikes you that maybe is not widely known?
I think that, you know, that one big change that's happened in terms of clinical management of people with autism is how we regard their very, very repetitive behavior. People with autism have these so-called obsessions and repetitive behaviors. And in the old days, that was seen as negative. And, you know, the advice was to try to prevent the person with autism from pursuing their obsession with the idea that perhaps it was stopping them from learning. I think what seems to have changed is that we now recognize that people with autism have a different learning style, and that maybe part of the way they learn is through repetition. That when they become over-focused on a specific topic, let's say a child who wants to learn everything there is to know about reptiles and will read encyclopedias about reptiles and watch videos about reptiles and buy magazines just about reptiles, you know, that although it's true that it's an obsession, this may be the way that the child learns. And if we, you know, if we don't let them learn in their own way, we may be doing them a disservice. And that the other thing is that sometimes you can use the child's obsession to help them learn about new material. So the fact that the child is indicating what they enjoy, what they find fascinating, for a good teacher, that would be an opportunity to find a connection with the child and then introduce new material that perhaps the teacher or the therapist feels would be useful. And, you know, we've done this in relation to a DVD that we developed called The Transporters.
Mm-hmm. Which I hope, I think we're going to be offering on our program, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Yes. But, you know, this is, it's a children's animation, and it's about, and all the characters are vehicles, like trains and trams and tractors and cable cars. And we included those just because many children with autism become obsessed with the wheels turning round on a train, or a train going round and round on a track. And so we're kind of using the obsession, but these vehicles all have faces, human faces, that show emotional expressions. So we're not having to resort to external rewards, bribing the child to take part in the therapy. Instead, we just offer them the DVD, and what we find is that they want to watch it because they love trains, they love vehicles, and that even without realizing it, they're being exposed to faces and being exposed to emotional expressions, so that they're getting the opportunity to pick up important information about the social world. So it's an example where you can use, you know, a child's obsession to actually open up the learning experience. Really what it's doing is, under normal circumstances, many children with autism will avoid looking at faces, and so they're missing out on social learning. And this is a way to reintroduce social learning in an autism-friendly format.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting when you talk about repetition. I noticed, as being a parent of my two daughters in their development, that repetition when they're very young is such a comforting thing for a young child. And my assumption is always that the world is so new and everything is so challenging because of its unfamiliarity, that the very thing that makes humor unhumorous to an adult, which is once you've heard a joke, you don't want to hear it again.
Yeah.
But it's the opposite for a child, that every time you do the joke again, it's funnier to the child.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what you're saying is true of typical kids, that they get comfort out of repetition. They want to have the same bedtime story, and they want to hear the same lullaby.
Yeah,
and you know that we all need some level of repetition, and if you just imagine that for a child with autism, It's just the same, only multiplied by 10 or 100 or 1,000. You know, that they just need a lot more of that repetition because the social world is so confusing. But that if we were trying to deprive them of that, you know, and that used to be the clinical advice, you know, to discourage the child's obsessions.
Mm.
You know, I think we could be missing an opportunity to help the child to grow.
Yeah, that sounds really very important. Our program has a large secular community, humanist community, naturalist, atheist, agnostic community. Has there been any work on a relationship between Asperger's and irreligiosity?
I'm only aware of one study recently which found that people with Asperger's were less religious than typical individuals in terms of any belief in God.
Mm.
And the argument was that maybe when typical individuals develop a belief in God, it's because they're imagining a God with a mind who can not just watch them but talk to them and imagine God's thoughts. And so, in a sense, what we're doing when we think of this invisible entity of a God is we're sort of imbuing him or her with all kinds of human characteristics,
mm-hmm.
including a mind and thoughts and emotions. So, you know, the idea was that if people with Asperger's syndrome are less focused on other people's thoughts and emotions, that would be true for a God just as for other people. So, you know, I think it's a topic that hasn't received a lot of research attention. You know, the opposite view is that theology is often a very orderly world. You know, that in different religions, theology has a very elaborate set of rules about how you should live and, you know, how the world has come into being. And the rules of the particular religion, and that for people with autism or Asperger's, if they need predictability and structure, they might actually be attracted to a theological perspective.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, there's not really enough evidence yet, but you could imagine that for some people with autism, you know, a belief in a human-like God might not be so such a strong need, whereas for other people with autism, that very predictable framework that religion provides might be very reassuring in an otherwise very unpredictable social world.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just know that I've experienced personally, and nothing scientific about my personal experience, but I know that when I socialize with people who are explicitly atheistic or non-religious, often it seems that I'm encountering a lot less social savvy in general, social cues where, you know, you're saying, well, okay, I guess it's time to, and somebody else will just be. And then in 1924, as if there's been no cues sent that we're ending the conversation now. Whereas if I'm talking to people from some synagogue or some church group, I don't seem to encounter that as much. And that's just a personal experience, which I've asked other people in the community if they've experienced that kind of thing, and some people resonate with that.
Yeah, as I say, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know of enough research which has looked at, you know, whether people who are more religious are likely to have more empathy,
right.
Or people who are more atheist are likely to have more autistic traits. Which is what I think you're implying. But I think it would certainly be a very interesting area for future research.
Your work is so important. I know that you mentioned The Age of Empathy by Franz de Waal and The Empathic Civilization by Jeremy Rifkin. We've had Jeremy Rifkin on this program and
right. His
great work. And there's a new book out by Sam Harris, Free Will, which also I think is connected to this idea of questioning whether people deserve the outcomes in life that our society seems to think they deserve. So I think you're part of a zeitgeist. We had Bruce Waller, who wrote this wonderful book called Against Moral Responsibility. It came out in November. And also another book which is saying we really need to think about, are we supporting fair outcomes? And does a society have the right to harm people, even if they do harm others? And you seem to, when you talk about the death penalty at the end of your book and talk about this retributive justice, really seem to be asking us to consider if we're not ourselves just as questionable in our behavior, just as harmful as the person that we seem to be righteously punishing.
That's right. Certainly that's my view, that you know, we can very easily become no better than the criminal that we aim to punish if we treat the criminal as less than human. So,
yes,
you know, it's a topic that I think needs wider discussion. But you know, I think giving empathy a place in society, whether it's in the criminal justice system or in the educational system, or in parenting, as we talked about, you know, my argument is that there's a, you know, there's a value for empathy in many different areas of human activity.
Absolutely, and you're a eloquent advocate of it. And I thank you so much for your work and for joining us today on Equal Time for Free Thought.
Thank you for talking today. I've really enjoyed it.
This has been great. Thank you, Dr. Cohn, and hopefully we will hear from you again.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Great.